time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 7th, 2018. The beginning of July always coincides with two of the most famous and brutal cycling events, the Giro Rosa for women and the Tour de France for men. This year, 24 teams will be racing the 979-kilometer, 10-stage Giro Rosa, sticking mainly to the north of Italy. There's plenty of climbing, including a brutal 11.9% uphill time trial, and the competition for the coveted spot on the top of the podium will be fierce. In addition, the 201-kilometer Grand Départ of the 105th edition of the Tour de France started this morning, July 7th. This year, the race will be almost entirely in its home country of France, and there are some new twists to the three-week 3,351-kilometer event, especially Stage 17. To help flesh it all out for us, I've invited Dan Worry back to give us some insight into the Giro Rosa, the controversy around Chris Froome, and his thoughts on some of the teams and riders this year. Then after a break, it's off to Ottawa, Canada, to speak with Brent Curry. We've spoken with many, many frame builders over the past 7.5 years, and along with several other supporting cast members such as Don Ferris of Anvil Bike Works and Joe Bell, who is arguably one of the finest painters in our business, there is Brent Curry. Brent is a mechanical engineer, and he's developed some pretty quirky and interesting products, such as the bicycle couch and the treadmill bike. But Brent's real claim to fame is Bike CAD. It's the program over 2,000 builders, fitters, designers, and amateur frame builders use to design and refine their frames before putting torch to metal or resin to fabric. I talk with Brent about his background, his couch bike, and more in an extended conversation in the second half of the show. I'd like to take a moment before heading down to South Carolina to talk with Dan to mention the passing of a good friend and a great advocate for cycling from the Northeast Ohio area. Oliver Cycle was killed while riding in the Great Ohio Bicycle Adventure on June 22nd. From all accounts, Oliver failed to stop at a stop sign and was hit crossing a high-speed road. I don't know what that momentary lack of consciousness or awareness was for Oliver, but I do know he was a kind and committed member of the cycling community and will be greatly missed. So our deepest condolences go out to his wife, Meredith. So let's head down to South Carolina for a conversation with Dan Worry about the two biggest races of the season. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's Tour de France time.
It is. I'm always glad to be here. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah. So before we get to the tour, I think we should chat about the 29th edition of the Giro Rosa.
It's going to Giro Rosa, yes, only days away.
Right. And so, unfortunately, you and I are talking before it happens. So we can just sort of chat about what we think might happen, and then, you know, we'll find out after, I guess it starts on Friday, right?
Let me think. It starts on the 6th.
Yeah, so, that's Friday. Yeah. So do you have any favorites coming into it?
Oh, gosh, there's, you know, lots of favorites, obviously, in any race of this caliber. But, Diane, since it is the 4th of July week, and since you and I are both in the United States, I think it would be unpatriotic of me if I didn't pick Megan Guarnier of Bowles Dolmans as certainly a top favorite. She is a native of New York. I think we've talked about her in the past. She is a multi-time U.S. National Road Champion, and not incidentally was the winner of the Giro Rosa in 2016.
But the defending champion is not going to be there this year, so she has a good chance of, like, stepping in, right?
That's right. So actually, the defending champion, Anna van der Breggen, is also of Bols Dolmond and is stepping out. She has decided that she's going to race in the Mountain Bike World Cup this year. So she is foregoing the Giro Rosa. So this is a great opportunity for Megan. You know, she had a tremendous 2016 season. You know, in addition to winning the Giro, she won the Tour of California that year. The Philadelphia Cycling Classic was really on fire in 2016. 2017 was a really difficult year for her. She started early in the season and had a very bad crash and had a, you know, was dealing with the side effects of a concussion early on in the season. She managed to sort of rally back by the time of the Giro and helped her teammate Anna van der Breggen win that race. Megan was fourth, I think, last year at the Giro, and you know, looked to be in really great condition heading into Worlds, and then had another accident in that race and broke her jaw.
Ugh.
So really difficult 2017 after this you know, amazing 2016 for her. And so now the question here for the current year is just you know, where her form finds her going into the Giro. I think we've got some pretty good indication that she is bouncing back. She was 12th at Strade Bianche, 10th at Flanders, won the Tour de Yorkshire. So, you know, she seems to be back on form, and you know, the Giro could be a great opportunity for her to recapture that title.
You know, I hope she's good at uphill time trials. I don't know who thinks this stuff up, but the Queen stage, 11.9% grade. Who do you, is she suited to this, or is somebody, do you think, better suited to the time trial?
Yeah, you know, no doubt that is a doozy of an uphill time trial. You know, I think certainly Megan is a very strong climber, so, you know, could very well suit her. You know, I think Elisa Longo Borghini of Wiggle High Five, who was second at the Giro last year, so certainly has shown her chops, and, you know, she just won here recently the mountains classification at the OVO Energy Women's Tour. So she would be a strong candidate who has shown that she is climbing really well. The other person I would say to watch is Annemiek van Vleuten of Michelin Scott. It really is considered maybe the favorite in the race by many. She is the current time trial world champion. You might remember her, Diane. She had that devastating crash at the Olympics in Rio, was really poised to probably take a medal.
Right.
And then on the final descent there into back into Rio, had that horrible, horrible crash, you know, is showing great form. And so I would be a little surprised if maybe one of the three of those ladies don't take the whole thing this year.
Well, you know, it's interesting how these athletes bounce back from these type of crash. It's like when Taylor Finney broke his leg, it was like, is he ever going to race again? And yet there he is back on the circuit.
That was a real scare. Not only back on the circuit, but you know, Taylor Finney's going to be one of five or six Americans riding in the Tour this year.
Exactly. I guess we should talk about the Tour. But first, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with our guy, Dan Worry from Velo News, and we're talking about the Tour de France. Obviously, the big story is Chris Froome. UCI decided to dismiss the doping charges. It's like deja vu all over. What's going on?
Well, so the, you know, the case of Chris Froome has been a really interesting one over the past year. You know, he has been sort of under a cloud of suspicion related to an anti-doping, I guess I need to phrase this carefully, a potential anti-doping violation that stemmed back from the Vuelta a España last year. Here's the thing maybe that people need to know about this. You know, Diane, there are at least two different kinds of violations in the world of anti-doping. There are certainly prohibited substances that are not allowed in your body in any way, shape, or form, right? So when we hear somebody testing positive for EPO or, you know, some banned substance, you know, that's a positive test and obviously a very serious matter. There are other substances, though, that really in some cases are expected. We call these specified substances in the world of anti-doping. And so these are medications, for example, that you may reasonably be taking under a doctor's care. They are allowable under certain circumstances, usually with a doctor's note, but also in specified concentrations. And so the case with Chris Froome was that he had nearly double the permissible amount of a substance called salbutamol. And you know, those of you who are familiar with asthma, salbutamol is, you know, what you would take in an asthma inhaler.
Right.
Froom is well known to have asthma. And so the issue was not that they found this asthma medication in his urine, as they would have expected to. It was just the concentration of it was especially high, as measured during an in-competition test back in the 27 Vuelta, which he won, incidentally. So it's a little different from having a positive test for a banned substance. And so, you know, in this case, it should have been something that was kept confidential. But in the case of the four-time Tour de France winner having an adverse analytical finding, you know, obviously this leaked out, and I'm sure has been something of a nightmare for Froome and for Team Sky, because it has really cast this cloud of suspicion over them here over the past 9 months. And, you know, not surprisingly, the sport has a very troubled history with performance enhancers, and so, you know, anytime, you know, particularly a rider of Chris Froome's caliber even potentially runs afoul of the anti-doping system, all kinds of red flags go up. And whether that's fair to him personally or not, I mean, it is definitely a reflection of the very troubled history in the sport. So they have been working to sort of sort this out over a period of 9 months. There was a very big question as to whether Froome should ride in the Giro, which he, you know, not only did eventually race, but really dramatically won after kind of a slow start, after a crash in the lead up to the Giro. And so, you know, we have seen an incredibly dramatic week on the Froome front. There has been this question of whether or not he would race even at the Tour de France, or whether this would be resolved by then. Only 2 or 3 days ago, at least as of the time that you and I are talking right now, Diane, the Amaury Sport Organization, the ASO, which is the organizer of the Tour de France, announced that they were going to prohibit him from starting in the race. That was kind of a questionable move, that, you know, whether or not it would have stood up to legal scrutiny in the days leading up to the tour is really open question. But, you know, on Monday, you know, as you mentioned, the UCI announced basically that it had just closed the case. It clearly has been working closely with the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. They cited, you know, all sorts of expert opinions here. They cited the guidance of WADA, and it's interesting that they have, you know, clearly they have coordinated this Froome case with WADA and you know, taken their guidance very much into consideration. WADA has already announced that they will not appeal the UCI's decision here to drop the case. And so, you know, ultimately the case against Chris Froome was dropped. And so it's not a question of guilt or innocence on this adverse analytical finding. Basically what they're saying is it wasn't an adverse analytical finding in the first place. That is, a little controversial, and that, you know, the way that this something like this is typically resolved, they try to recreate the conditions under which this, you know, this potential finding happened, to see if they could reproduce under permissible circumstances the concentration of that drug in his urine sample. Basically what they said was, so we can't recreate the circumstances. You know, the circumstances in this case are, you know, we're talking about a rider who had been in, a world-class three-week grand tour, who had been ill, who had been, you know, prescribed apparently a higher dose of this medication by his doctor. And so, you know, basically WADA has said, there's no way for us reasonably to recreate exactly the circumstances under which this happened. And so they have foregone that test that would usually happen in this circumstance, and they have dropped it altogether. And so now, after a 9-month period during which it was a very open question as to whether, you know, Chris Froome's Vuelta win last year would continue to stand, and indeed, you know, whether his recent Giro victory would stand, and whether he would be facing some sort of ban, in the end, all of those results will stand. There is no ban, and we are expecting to see Chris Froome line up at the tour here this coming weekend, and really no reason not to consider him the favorite.
Neither of us are doctors, so I don't know if it's a performance-enhancing drug, this asthma medication. It makes it so that he can perform based on having his lungs work. And, you know, when you can't breathe, it's scary. So I understand that if he needs that to breathe, but I know there's also so much, I don't know, mystery around the sport in this regard that there's a lot of naysayers out there. So we'll see what happens.
Definitely so. I mean, it's a very hard, you know, as you and I talked earlier, that there is a lot of controversy around this decision. You know, I mean, I think in fairness to Froome, on the basis of all of the evidence, which incidentally we have not seen, there's actually very, very little about this case that has been made public at this point. We do not have the full reasoned decision. We really don't know entirely what their defense even was in this case. In fairness, you know, both the UCI and the World Anti-Doping Agency have agreed that this should not have been considered an adverse analytical finding. And so, you know, in fairness to him, I mean, rightfully so, he should be able to ride the tour. And, you know, and in fairness to critics, this is a sport where over a period of 100 or more years, where there is smoke, there has often been fire.
Yep.
And so it's, you know, it's a really difficult question.
Let me remind our listeners one more time. We're speaking with Dan Worry. We're talking about Chris Froome. We're going to move on from that. He is starting the tour this week. And so the question is he the favorite? Is he going to step up as the favorite?
I don't see now. I mean, I think that, you know, the open question here is whether the stress of this situation has, you know, had any impact on Chris Froome and or his teammates. But recent history would prove, I mean, just, you know, back in May, he came back and, you know, won the Giro in pretty decisive fashion. So it's always an open question on a grand tour. I mean, anything can happen, and, you know, anything from a minor mechanical issue to, an unexpected crash can sort of throw the whole race into disarray. But just in terms of strong competitors, I mean, I can't see how Chris Froome isn't the favorite.
Yeah.
Consider, Diane, that he has won now the past three grand tours. He won the tour, he won the Vuelta, and now he's won the Giro. So he hasn't lost a grand tour in a year.
There are other teams racing, not just Team Sky.
Yeah.
There are actually 22 teams, and several of them have had really good spring seasons. I think Bora Hansgrohe and BMC come to mind. And then we have teams that are representing areas of the world that have now become regular tour teams, teams you didn't think you might see, like the UAE and the African teams. Things seem to be opening up in a diverse sort of way. What do you think?
Well, yes and no. So
okay.
Maybe we'll take those in reverse order. Yes, we definitely have a team from the UAE. We have Dimension Data, which is registered in Africa and is the former MTN Quebec team. It's interesting, though, looking at the tour squads for those teams, Diane, the peloton at the Tour de France is overwhelmingly European, even in the case of those two teams.
That's
so,
true.
You know, Dimension Data really at this point is the team of Mark Cavendish. And so, you know, we've got, you know, Cavendish and Mark Renshaw and, you know, riders like that who are helping him out. There are two South African riders on the Dimension Data squad for the tour. But, you know, the UAE team is, you know, just sort of a global mix. There really is not any great representation from the Middle East there. They've got kind of an interesting team. Darwin Adepuma, who is a well-known climber, used to ride for BMC. Sprinter Alexander Kristoff is in the mix. Dan Martin, who is a former winner of Liège-Bastogne-Liège. And so, you know, kind of an interesting mix with UAE on, you know, guys that very potentially could take a stage win. And, you know, the same thing with Dimension Data. And, you know, obviously we would, you know, Mark Cavendish is always a threat to take, you know, many, many sprint stages at the tour. But yeah, so sort of interesting that, you know, the globalization, I guess, of the teams may be better reflected right now in the location of the ownership and the registration of those teams, really, than in the actual riders who are participating. And then, you know, certainly Bora Hansgrohe and BMC have had, you know, strong spring seasons. But as you know well, there's a big difference between the spring races and the Grand Tours.
That's true.
You know, the kinds of riders who specialize in the cobbled classics, for example, are very different from a Chris Froome type rider who is strong all around and is a climber and is a time trialist. So you can't necessarily equate a strong spring season to a strong showing in the Grand Tours. still, those teams, though, have lots to look out for here at the Tour. Bora Hansgrohe, obviously, is the team of Peter Sagan, first and foremost. Sagan is the five-time winner of the Green Points jersey at the Tour. You might remember he was thrown out of the Tour de France last year because of an unusual crash that, from one camera angle, looked very much like Sagan might have been to blame for a crash that involved Mark Cavendish and, knocked Cavendish out of the race. Sagan was thrown out of the race last year by the race jury and then subsequently received an apology. Different camera angles came to light where it became pretty clear that he didn't even touch Cavendish.
Right. I remember that.
Kind of a sad situation. I expect that this will be a great tour for Peter Sagan in the sense that we were talking about sort of the diversification of the teams. Bora Hansgrohe also has Rafael Majka, who is a specialist in the mountains and will be kind of their general classification rider. I still think first and foremost, Bora is the team of Peter Sagan and will be helping Sagan to meet his goals. But maybe after losing Sagan early in the race last year, they've recognized the merits of diversifying a bit. And then, you mentioned BMC, a team that has some very strong general classification riders, including TJ Van Garderen, who is an American, and also Richie Port on that team, former teammate of Chris Froome's at Team Sky. And so, both of those guys are really accomplished and promising, general classification riders. They have not, either of them, had great success at the Tour in the past, but are really always kind of perennial threats.
One of the things I wanted to talk about before I let you go, because you're getting us all excited here about watching these riders, is what's actually changed with the Tour. They're doing a lot of things for the fans. Some of the stages are changing in terms of where the start is and where the endings are. What's new and changed for the Tour for 2018?
Well, a couple of interesting things happening at the Tour. They are limiting team size, so we'll have 176 riders that are lining up at the Tour. It is a little bit later than usual, too. I don't know if you realize that. I think most American cycling fans are used to being able to wake up on the 4th of July and turn on the Tour de France, and it is going to be starting a couple days later. There was a conflict this year with the FIFA World Cup, and so they are bumping the Tour by a week. A couple of interesting changes, though. They have something new that they're trying this year that relates to bonus seconds on the first nine stages of the Tour. So they are going to pick a predetermined spot. You're probably familiar with the fact that there are typically bonus seconds awarded for stage wins in the Grand Tours, but they are going for the first nine stages of this Tour to pick a predetermined spot somewhere along the route, and will be giving the first three riders across that particular point, 3, 2, and 1 seconds bonus respectively. So that'll be kind of an interesting thing to watch for kind of mid stage, particularly in this year will be no different. Some of the early stages of the Tour tend to be flat and frankly kind of boring until the sprint finishes. Adding those bonus points at various stages along the route will be interesting. One of the other things that I think is going to be really interesting to watch is going to be the 17th stage of the race this year. It is going to be one of the shortest Tour de France stages ever, only 65 kilometers in length. It's going to be kind of a short, violent stage, I suspect. 38 of those kilometers are climbing. They're going to finish on the Col de Portet, which is at 2,215 meters. It is the highest ever summit finish in the Tour in the Pyrenees.
Okay, that's crazy.
There's been a lot of speculation, though, as to how is this very short stage, typically a Tour de France stage is in excess of 100, certainly in excess of 100 kilometers, typically more than 100 miles a day. And so, a 65-kilometer stage is really unusually short. It's going to be interesting to see how this one plays out. Because of the short nature of that stage, they're doing a couple of things that are going to be different. First, there will be, on that particular stage, no neutral starts. fans who are used to watching the Tour on television may not be quite as familiar with this concept, because typically TV coverage of the stages picks up anywhere from, you know, an hour or two into the stage. So typically in a stage, there is a neutral start where it's sort of the race isn't exactly on yet while everyone right. is kind of getting their groups organized. So there will be no neutral start.
Hmm.
And then they're also doing something very unusual for the Tour, and they're going to have what they're calling a grid-style start. You're probably more familiar with this from, like, running races where the favorites are kind of grouped up in front, and then the more recreational folks are grouped at the back.
They seed them, yeah.
Right, so there's sort of a seeding system. So they'll be doing that. There are going to be five different groups in this start. So, you know, given the short nature of that stage, you know, the top 20 riders will be in group one and all positioned at the front of the pack at the start. And then, you know, respectively, they'll be moving back based on the riders standing at that point. So, you know, I would definitely point to that 17th stage as an unusual dual one, and definitely something to tune in for.
The last thing I want to talk about is the length of the Tour itself. There has been some talk, and there seems to always be some talk about actually shortening some of these Grand Tours. The Giro, which of course started out of Europe and came back to Europe, that seemed to work out okay, but it still was a 3-week race. Do you believe that the Tour maybe is too long? Would shortening it be better?
I don't believe for a second that that's going to happen. I mean, it really is something that I will believe it when I see it,
right.
You know, particularly as relates to the Tour de France. Now, you know, whether that conversation might eventually creep into a race like the Vuelta a España may be a different question. But boy, you know, the Tour de France is the sort of the centerpiece of the sport, and as steeped in history and tradition as that race is, I think it's very unlikely that we're going to see a shortened version of the Tour de France anytime soon.
Well, I just thought it would be worth asking. You know why I thought it was late this year? I thought it was late because the 1st of July actually happened on a Sunday, but I didn't realize it was a FIFA thing. So it makes
sense. No, it's a FIFA thing. So they I think in terms of TV coverage and other logistics scheduling wise, they have bumped it back a year. I'm sorry, bumped it back a week, not a year.
Yeah, no, it won't be a year. Well, we will have to see. And I'm very excited for this year's Tour. I would love to see something like crazy happen and not have Chris Froome win. Not like I don't like Chris Froome, because I think he's really a cool rider, but just to see something different, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The past couple of years, Froome has actually kept things sort of interesting. I mean, if you look at the Giro, you know, he was really largely written off out of that race. He had a crash sort of during the warm-up on the first day of the Giro, so before the race even began. I think he was sort of assessing the time trial course and had a crash, finished well off of where he would typically expect to be, had a really rough, all things being relative, Diane. He didn't have a rough week, you know, for me. He had a rough week for Chris Froome. So,
right.
he was in like 10th place instead of in first place. But, the better part of the Giro, he was, you know, well out of contention even to land on the podium, and then really turned things on toward the end and you know, made that race very exciting. So, you know, we'll see. A lot's going to happen, but it is interesting. You know, Froome is a four-time winner at this point. He has been so dominating, over these past three Grand Tours. So it'll be interesting to see if anybody can hold the candle to him.
Well, we are going to sit back and see, or do whatever we do.
Yeah.
Well, as always, so interesting and so informative. Thank you, Dan. Let's watch a brand new Tour for 2018 and see who comes out on top. Thanks so much for your time.
That's right.
All right.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dan Worry joined me to chat about the Giro Rosa and the Tour de France. He's always so well-informed. You can read Dan's columns and commentary in Velo News. He's at the back. So let's take a short break, and then we'll talk with BikeCad's Brent Curry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Thank you.
are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. My next guest has done some very interesting things with bikes and furniture. He's also the creator of BikeCAD. Here's my conversation with Brent Curry.
Hi, Brent. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
It's my pleasure. I guess we should start at the beginning. I'd like to know, and our listeners would like to know, where you grew up and when you started riding.
I grew up in a cul-de-sac in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. I started riding as soon as I was old enough to turn the pedals on a tricycle. I always loved bikes as a kid. In particular, I think I really liked how they take you places. I don't think I was born with an interest in racing, but I did eventually get a road bike and joined the local cycling club when I was 15.
That's pretty young.
Yeah.
Did you do some road racing? I know you did triathlon.
Yeah, I did get into racing that first year when I was 15. I, at the time, I was excited to try triathlons, but they had an age restriction where you couldn't register till you were 16. So the summer I was 15, I did some road racing, a lot of crits, which I think maybe didn't suit me too well at the time. I didn't really have a lot of explosive power. So that kind of turned me off bike racing a little bit, but got me ready for my first crack at triathlons when I was 16.
So you're the older of the two brothers? You have a brother, I think Scott is his name?
Yeah, my brother Scott is just 2 years younger than me. We share the same birthday.
That's interesting. What is that? What day is that?
June 30th.
So happy birthday.
Oh, actually, it's not my birthday yet, I don't think.
Well, it isn't today, but it will be tomorrow. You and I are talking on June 29th.
Yeah.
So this show will actually air on July 7th, but I'm going to wish you happy birthday anyway.
Well, thank you very much.
And your brother. So tell me about your portion of triathlon. Did you do the whole thing or did you just do the cycling? Did you do a whole try?
Oh, yeah. Like, I have probably done 50 or, I don't know, 100 triathlons in my life. But
wow.
I guess I've lost track. But, I did the whole thing. I wasn't, I guess, mostly Olympic distance triathlons, which would be a 1,500-meter swim, a 40K bike, and a 10K run. That first year I got into triathlons when I was 16, I did a half Ironman and done a whole bunch of them as well. My brother eventually took to triathlons as much as I did. Much more. He became a professional Ironman triathlete. So he was actually the Canadian long course champion 1 year. And myself, it was always, I guess, I was very much an amateur, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. I never actually did an Ironman distance. I kind of decided at some point along the line that I was best suited to sort of the Olympic distance.
Yeah, good to know what you what your specialties are and not like turn yourself into mincemeat. So what was your favorite racing bike?
Well, I guess my first racing bike was a Benoto, I believe, made in Mexico.
Right.
That served me pretty well until I eventually got a V2s, a French-made bonded aluminum bike, which was nice because I think because I own that V2s, eventually I wound up, well, when I went to university, I did mechanical engineering in university, and it was in a co-op program, so I did work terms interspersed with my schooling, and really wanted to get in to work with a bike company, and I applied to a whole bunch of bike companies and for my first term and didn't really get much of a response. But one bike company, which I did at the last minute send a resume off to, only because I kind of found this little card from the bike that I owned, sent it off to V2s. They actually gave me an opportunity for a work term. So eventually I got a second carbon V2s from them after working for them for a summer, and enjoyed racing on that a number of years. Eventually got a DeKerf bike, which I did a lot of racing on as well, and still actually ride to this day. I've also inherited a very nice guru triathlon bike from my sponsored brother, Scott, which is also, perhaps I should say, my favorite bike because it is most suited to triathlon. But the Decurf, on the other hand, has seen many more miles, and I do have a special spot in my heart for my Decurf. So
nice. Nice.
Yeah.
So I guess instead of hand me down, it was hand me up because you're the older one. So you got the got the bike from your brother. So let's talk about bikes and other moving vehicles you've developed. You have some really kind of quirky stuff, a couch bike and a treadmill bike. So I know you still have the couch bike because I read that you still ride it with people and I've seen a picture of it. What the hell is it?
Well, it's just a bike I built around my living room couch. It's actually meant, it's sort of adjustable to fit a variety of couches, but it is just a frame, and you can pick up a couch, place it on top of this frame. There's a wheel on the side of, on either side of the couch, and you sit, two people can sit in the couch, put their feet up in front of themselves, sort of like they're sitting on an ottoman with, But there's actually pedals in front of them. So you can place your feet on these pedals. There's chains that run under the couch to a couple of rear wheels that are in the back. So there's a total of four wheels on the bike. Each drivetrain is independent, so each rider can just pedal at their own pace. And the person on the left has a little tiller that they hold at the armrest, and they steer the bike with that. And I built the bike in the summer of 2002 and thought it would be fun to do a big bike trip on it. And coincidentally, I had heard a few months earlier from a friend I'd known in high school. He visited Canada as a foreign exchange student from Norway, and he'd gotten in touch with me probably, I guess, about 10 years after his exchange, and was just telling me his coming to Canada, I wanted to know if I'd want to do a trip with him somewhere. So I guess I'd had this idea to, I don't think I'd started building the couch bike at that point, but I told him I was thinking about building it, wondered if he'd want to do a trip on that with me, and he accepted my proposal. So yeah, I did a trip on it with my friend, my Norwegian friend, Ivan. We traveled from Miramichi, New Brunswick, in Atlantic Canada to, through Prince Edward Island. We actually rode right across Prince Edward Island from the west coast to the east coast. And, I've continued to enjoy riding it over the years. I was living in Kitchener, Waterloo, Ontario for the longest time, but eventually, with my wife, we moved to Vancouver a couple years ago, had to kind of leave the couch bike in storage, and when we left Vancouver for my wife's current job in Ottawa, kind of accepted that we'd have to sell off a lot of my bikes that were in storage in Kitchener-Waterloo, so I got rid of a number of bikes, but held onto the couch bike.
Of course you did.
But have not brought it to Ottawa yet. It's actually at a friend's house in Waterloo.
I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Brent Curry. He is the founder of Bike CAD, and we're going to talk about that in the second half of our interview. But I wanted to hear about all this really cool stuff. So all you have to do is go to the internet and type in couch bike, and you will see the couch bike, the one you made. There have evidently been some copycats of it, or people are just putting different couches on your particular chassis, I guess we'd call it. Pretty interesting stuff. The other bike I want to talk about is the treadmill bike because it became famous somehow. Tell us about the treadmill bike. This is an engineer. I'm telling you, I know all about this stuff. You guys come up with this stuff in your head and it happens.
Yeah. Well, the treadmill bike is something I just thought it would be fun to make. I figured it wouldn't take much work. So I just did it mostly just for kicks. It was also sort of to poke fun at people that drive their car to the gym only to run on a treadmill. I figured I'd make this treadmill that you can actually use to move around, as though it's not obvious that you could also just walk places or run places. So I made this thing, and I guess also partly because it was sort of a novel thing to try to ride, because it's a bit of a challenge to ride, but it's just a treadmill mounted on this long bike frame with a typical handlebar that is about chest height when you're standing on the treadmill, and another wheel in the back that rubs up against the belt of the treadmill and therefore moves the treadmill forward as you run or walk on the treadmill. After I built it, I made a little mock advertisement on my website, and I guess some news agencies or people were taken in by this, what I thought was a pretty obvious joke, but they, I guess, took it as this real product. So as a result, it did experience some viral success with, I guess, appearances on German television shows, I guess a few British television shows, a whole bunch of Japanese television shows. I actually got to travel to Los Angeles to film one of the Japanese television shows, and then actually wound up scoring a trip to Japan for another stint with a treadmill bike. So it's been fun to show that off, and I wound up selling one of the. I never really intended to build too many of them, but at one point, I guess the Price is Right approached me about having it on as a product in their showcase showdown. So in order to make that happen, I needed to actually come up with a second bike. So I built another bike for that purpose. Eventually sold first bike. Eventually I sold my second treadmill bike to a Japanese TV show that used it for this segment that involved a chimpanzee riding the treadmill bike.
I'm sorry.
I think it's my very first treadmill bike that I still have to this day in my garage, and I'd actually be happy to unload it if anyone were interested in having it at this stage.
We'll let people figure out how to contact you right, you know, toward the end of our show. Go online again. All you have to do is type in treadmill bike and you'll see it. It's actually pretty clever, but I love your original idea for it. For the person who we used to be, our shop used to be right next door to a fitness studio. People would drive around the parking lot to see how close they would get, toss their cigarettes out as they were approaching the fitness studio, get on the treadmill for like, or elliptical bike for 10 minutes, leave, get in their car and go home. We used to laugh at those people. It's like, what's the point? Right?
Yeah.
All right. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Brent Curry. Now we're going to talk about, actually, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about BikeCAD. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Okay, we're back, and if you're just joining me, I am talking with Brent Curry. He is the man of BikeCAD.ca. He's in Ottawa, Canada. So let's talk about this engineering stuff. How did you, why did you come up with BikeCAD?
Well, when I was a mechanical engineering student at the University of Waterloo, I did a whole bunch of work terms for bike companies. First Vitus in France, and then Synchros in Vancouver, BC, and Southcott's proprietary in Australia, where I helped develop Australia Post mail delivery bikes, and then a couple work terms for Chris DeKerf, custom frame builder in Vancouver. At each of these places, I would wind up having to draw. Make engineering drawings of bicycles, and this is at a time when I guess things are very much in transition in the drafting world. So some of those drawings were done by hand, pencil and paper, and then I'd use things like AutoCAD and some solid modeling tools as well. But all these solid modeling tools that were considered cutting edge at the time. We're all very expensive cutting edge CAD tools. A lot of them were, or the very best were parametric CAD tools, which meant that you'd make a model, and then you can the dimensions defining the model are parametric, so you can change one of the dimensions, and the whole model updates. It was sort of a step forward from the early versions of AutoCAD, where if you want to make a dramatic change to, say, the length of a dimension on your bicycle drawing, you'd have to kind of redraw a lot of the whole bike because these are just sort of dumb lines that are drawn on the screen. Whereas a parametric model, it's more flexible. You can change one number, the whole model updates. Anyway, at the time, all the software was very expensive, so I wound up sort of replicating some of the principles of parametric CAD using a spreadsheet like Microsoft Excel, and having a spreadsheet such as that eventually led me to the idea of writing a program to take the sort of the spreadsheet formulas and also draw the bike on the screen. So I came up with the primitive version of BikeCAD to do that, to just take some of the key driving dimensions that you want to use to design a bicycle frame and show a drawing on the screen and eventually calculate all the lengths and angles at which you need to cut the tubes to build the bike. And I did that for, well, mostly just for fun, but also when I graduated from school, I did intend to build some bikes for myself. So I developed the software for fun so that I could design and build my bikes. I built three mountain bikes in my garage. I also modified the program to handle tandems. I built three tandems in my garage and made the program freely available on my website. It ran as a Java applet, which were quite easy to run back in the day. Any browser would just automatically launch this little widget when you went to a particular page on my site, and left it there for people to use as they wished for a period of time. I didn't really do any further development on it until the people at Cirata approached me about customizing the program for their needs. So I worked with them for a little while to make a version of the program that ran on the Cirata website. And through working with them, I realized that there probably was a greater potential for the program, and probably all custom builders could benefit from something like this. So I started selling BikeCAD, what I now call BikeCAD Pro, back in 2004, and have just been adding functionality to it ever since.
Does your program now offer what I would call 3D? Can you actually flip this around and look at it different ways?
It does consider the dimensions of the bike in three dimensions. It takes into account the dropout spacing and other width dimensions, and it will show you an auxiliary view of the seat stays and the chain stays, and it will show you an overhead view where you can examine toe overlap and so on. So it is taking into account all three dimensions, but you actually can't render the bike in a way that you can rotate around.
So is it available to amateurs? I mean, so let's say I wanted to, I went to your website and I clicked on this, right, and it was still loading when I called you. So I said, okay, the hell with it. But I guess what I want to know is, how much do you need to know about frame geometry and fit to get a result that will work? I think a lot of people don't understand that, well, I want this and I want that, but they don't always go together. And when you actually put the bike on the road, there are a lot of things that could go wrong if you don't know what works with what and what doesn't work.
Right. Well, I think BikeCAD is a great tool to help educate yourself on a lot of these matters. And you don't need to know much to use it. There is a free version that runs on my website. It just runs inside your web browser, so you don't have to download anything or install anything. that version has traditionally run as a Java applet, which nowadays it's actually quite cumbersome to run a Java applet in a browser because most browsers don't support Java applets. For a while now, it's actually been a big deal for me because so many people want to try the free version and they would struggle to get this applet running, which is becoming increasingly more difficult to run because of changes in browser protocols. But just a few months ago, I was pretty happy to work out an arrangement with an organization called Weaning Tech that develops ChirpJ, and ChirpJ allows Java applets to run without a Java plugin. They do a whole lot of behind-the-scenes magic that I won't go into, but the free version of Bycat will run without any sort of plugin. You have the option to run it as a Java applet, but you don't have to. You can run it in any browser with no plugin. It does take a while to load. You have to sit there for a little while, but it will load in a cell phone or on a tablet or in any browser you like. And yeah, the user interface is pretty simple, but it does present various input fields where you can change any dimension you want on the bike. And just by fiddling around with it, you can learn a lot about frame geometry, understand how changing one dimension can affect other dimensions. And Bycat also presents various ways of controlling the frame geometry. You can do so by stack and reach. Stack is the distance from the bottom bracket to the top of the head tube measured vertically, and reach is the distance from the bottom bracket to the top of the head tube measured horizontally. Stack and reach are popular dimensions. When you go to a manufacturer's website and you learn about all their different sizes, they'll often present them in those terms. But you can also control the bike by front center and head tube length, or effective top tube length and top tube angle. And you can also control it by handlebar position. But by just playing around with a model, you can really learn a lot. And the tool also allows you to model a rider on the bike, and Bikehead will tell you the size of bike you need based on the rider's geometry. And here, I guess, is one area where I wouldn't necessarily suggest that someone who doesn't know anything about bike design should just go and try that and accept the results as gospel, because the Fit Advisor, which is this tool that does take body geometry and correlate it to frame geometry, it's fully customizable. So the idea behind it is that a fitter would customize it to suit their own fitting philosophy. And there are a whole bunch of different approaches to frame fit out there. And I try not to, I guess I just try to be fit agnostic and
great word.
Support all the different approaches that there are out there. And I think I've done pretty well on that front in making Bikehead flexible enough to suit whatever approach to fit you want to take.
Very diplomatic. That's the way I put it. Yeah, and you're absolutely right. So what are the fundamental differences between the free version and the pro version? And I also want to know who's actually using Bikehead, but let's talk about the differences, just basic differences. What do you get when you pay the money to get pro?
Well, although the free version now does once again run in most any browser, it is probably nicer to actually have Bikehead Pro, which runs as a standalone application on either a PC, a Mac, or on Linux. It doesn't take as long to load, but it also gives you access to all the dimensions necessary to build the bike. A lot of those dimensions are going to be grayed out in the free version. You can represent a rider on the bike. You can't actually show the rider on the bike in the free version, and a lot of the Fit Advisor functionality is also grayed out in the free version. You can print fully dimensioned drawings from Bikehead Pro. You can export all kinds of different files. You can export an animated GIF or a CSV file if you want to integrate it with a spreadsheet or integrate it with other CAD systems. You can customize Bikehead in a ton of different ways, again, using Bikehead Pro. And in terms of how many builders I have, I guess program's not just for builders, but it's for fit specialists as well. So I have just over 2,000 customers. And I guess I consider anyone who has bought the program at any point a customer, because what I charge $500 Canadian for the program, and that is always a one-time fee. So as new versions of the software come out, all owners get the new version at no extra charge.
I hear about Bycat. I've seen you. Actually, we haven't actually maybe met. Maybe we have.
I've been at, I guess you may be talking about NABS.
Maybe at NABS.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe there. Do you have any new, okay, Bycat must take up some of your time, but it probably doesn't take up all of your time because engineers always have other projects in their brains. What else are you doing? Do you have any new projects that you're going to be launching?
No, well, I am pretty devoted to Bycat, actually.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Any free time I have, I like to pour into the program. I'm still pretty passionate about it and still have lots more that I want to do with it. I guess if you ask what I do outside of that, I guess it really basically amounts to my three-year-old son who occupies most of my time otherwise.
Well, yeah. That's what they do. They do. So when do you take him riding? Do you take him like on the back of a bike or?
Yeah, we have a trail bike that he'll ride behind me on. He's also riding his own two-wheeler now with no training wheels. So,
he's three?
Yeah, he's...
That's pretty young.
Yeah, he's doing quite well. I guess we had him on a balance bike early on, so that really helped him develop his balance. And yeah, so he's a real rock star on this.
Yeah.
We picked up a Pello bike, which was pleased to note was designed using Bycat.
That's nice.
So,
do you actually make something available that can say designed by Bycat, like a sticker, a decal?
I have not thought to do that, but perhaps I should.
Why not? This bike was designed using Bycat. That sounds like something cool that you could like.
Yeah,
I like that idea. Of course, it's my idea. Why wouldn't I like it, right? All right. I get to ask you my three favorite questions, and you get to answer them. And then we're going to tell people how they can find out more about Bycat and to look at your other stuff, too. So what's your favorite food?
I like all foods, but...
Well, you're a cyclist. That's true, but go ahead. See if you can pick one.
Maybe I'll just say pad thai.
Ooh, good one. Spicy or not?
I like probably just mild.
Yeah, me too. What kind of music do you listen to?
A lot of different music, but maybe music with a bit of a folk tinge to it.
Okay. And do you have any pets?
We do currently have a betta fish named Sammy.
Aha. They're kind of feisty, yeah. Aren't they?
Kind of. What was the question?
Aren't they kind of feisty?
Feisty. I have heard that it's dangerous to put them in with other fish and stuff, but Sammy lives a solitary existence, and thus far he's been fitting quite well into our family. Our son enjoys feeding him.
Nice. Well, this has been really fun. So tell our listeners how they can find out more about the program and about the work you're doing, because your website is very extensive.
Right. Well, I hope people will check out bikecad.ca. There's a lot of video tutorials there describing the functionality of the program. And I've got various social media channels as well, but they're all linked through my website. And always try to be pretty quick to respond to emails if anyone has any questions. So look forward to hearing from people.
Well, that's great. Well, Brent, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. We will look for you. Are you going to be at NABS next time? It's in Sacramento in the spring or winter.
Yeah, this will be our 13th showing at NABS.
Wow.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Are you going to Philly?
I'm also going to Philly, yeah.
So I will see you in Philly. I will walk up to you in Philly and say hello because we will be at Philly this year, too.
All
very
right, great.
Cool.
I look forward to it.
All right.
Thank you very much for the call.
And thank you very much for talking with me. You have a great day.
Yeah, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Okay, bye. My thanks to Brent Curry for taking time to chat with me about Bycat and the couch bike today. Seems like a fun way to travel. You can find out more about Bycat and download the free version at bikecad.ca. My guess is after trying it, you might even like to sign up for the whole enchilada with the pro version. My thanks also to Dan Worry. As always, an informative and up-to-date conversation about riders and the racing scene. Next week, we'll be back with a brand new show. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, you can subscribe to our podcast at all the usual places, including the OutspokenCyclist.com blog.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Outspoken Cyclist without an E and comment on our Facebook page. A quick like and especially a review at your podcast app would be much appreciated too. So I hope you have a great week, stay safe, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.